All right, coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. And today we have a very special guest on the show. We have Randy Shaw, who is the director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic and the editor-in-chief of the online daily newspaper Beyond Cron. He's the author of three books, Beyond the Fields, The Activist Handbook, and Reclaiming America. I discovered Mr. Shaw recently. I feel bad that I'm late on discovering you, Mr. Shaw, and an essay he wrote for the LA Progressive about the failure of housing policy in the state of California. As many of you know that listen to the show, I work with the unhoused community here in Oakland, California, one of the emergency Operation Room Key shelters. And reading Mr. Shaw's work, I think, is very, very important right now in the middle of a pandemic, and also in the middle of what the pandemic is showing us is just how fragile our economy really is, because I believe we're facing a very large a homelessness crisis that we haven't seen probably since the Depression. Mr. Shaw, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me. Let me just add that my most recent book, which is all about how the housing crisis, is called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And it's about how cities have to do a better job at housing people.
In your opinion, what's the biggest flaw right now when it comes to cities not housing people? Because I know usually if we hear politicians' quick answer, it's always the cost of affordable housing, of building affordable housing.
Well, the causes of the housing crisis are so remarkably simple. It's not like trying to solve climate change, which involves a series of complex solutions that we haven't implemented. But starting in the 1970s, the United States federal government decided to get out of the affordable housing business. And we've had a homeless crisis since 1982 that has never been addressed through the federal budget. So it's not very complicated to understand why we have a tremendous crisis of people on the lowest end of the economy. My book and what I focus a lot about is how cities, by not building enough housing, have artificially inflated rents and home prices. I mean, the very simple, Los Angeles added a million people since 1970, many of whom are immigrants. Mm-hmm. They decided, well, we don't really need to be able to build any housing. We want to keep one story everywhere, and we don't want to have five-story apartment buildings. We don't want to build apartment buildings in most of the city. Well, how does that work? Well, that means you have Latino families living in garages or commuting 2 hours from where they can afford to live. And it's utter madness, and yet that is the housing policy for most of our blue cities.
What role does HUD play in that?
Well, HUD is the federal role, and we used to have a very significant HUD budget that most of the people who are eligible for federal housing assistance would get it. Today, less than one out of every four families entitled to federal assistance gets it. So what happens to the other three families? Well, they're either living with other people in overcrowded units, or they're on the street, or in shelters, or in some very unfortunate living situation. It's this is not how other countries do it, but this is America has just not funded housing for 40 years.
I kind of feel like we have a punitive view of how we view our housing projects. It's almost a punishment to live in government housing or affordable housing.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon decided to take America out of the public housing business, public housing was not doing well. Public housing, from the very start, there were other agendas associated with it that were not about housing poor people. Primarily, it was a patronage project. People like Chicago's Mayor Daley built these giant high-rises, which everybody knew, all the progressive folks posed, because they knew that didn't really work to cram all those low-income families in a 16-story high-rise. But he didn't care. He just cared about the patronage of the jobs he could dole out. So we've never really had a truly effective national public housing system. New York City used to be the model for successful public housing, and now it's a disaster because when you go 40 years of reduced budgets, things fall apart. So I think it's just a reflective of the housing situation for the low-income people of America is like the healthcare situation for that population. It's like the transit issues. The United States has decided not to provide public services to a significant percentage of its residents.
And it's interesting that you phrase it in that way, that because I think people don't really understand in context how that looks. So if I don't fund properly public housing, public transportation, as you live in it, as you have to ride it, the first thing you do is start pointing out the flaws. And you don't really understand that a lot of those flaws come from lack of funding.
Well, it's been a really brilliant strategy. And I say that for this reason. I was around when Ronald Reagan slashed the HUD budget dramatically in the 1981 budget, after his first budget after taking office. And we used to always talk about, if we ever can get a Democrat back in office, you know, we'll replenish it. But when we got Bill Clinton, it was not replenished. We got Barack Obama, it was not replenished, because politically there's problems in Washington with getting housing money. And so we've never had it replenished. And I think actually Joe Biden is the first Democratic candidate for president that I'm aware of since, you know, Roosevelt or Truman, that actually has a plan to dramatically increase the HUD budget. And that's because of activism that pushed all the candidates to do so. But that did not occur under Obama or Clinton.
Do you think in a Biden presidency, we'd actually see more affordable housing built, or even four-unit complexes built in single-family areas?
Well, absolutely. But I think, again, the credit goes to the activists, people from the groups. All there's like over 1,000 groups associated with this big, you know, more homes campaign led by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And there was more pressure during the primary season to get all the Democrats on board on housing platforms. We hadn't seen that in the past. So I think when Biden wins and takes office, there is a network of groups to push for more money that we didn't have in the past. And I want to just make sure people understand one point. The problem that we have as progressives with housing is when you go to Washington, the education and the healthcare groups that progressives support are just more powerful than the housing groups for many reasons. And we lose in the competition. I think that will not happen this time because of the groups, the powerful grassroots coalition that's been built.
So I watched recently, back to housing in California, I watched recently Gavin Newsom's press conference. I think it was last Thursday or Wednesday, where he was talking about his Operation Room Key, kind of touting the successes of it. And part of that program is to house the homeless people that are staying in the hotel shelters. And he said the solution to homelessness is permanent supportive housing. What's your take on that?
Well, you can't argue with what he says. But I have to be honest and say that Project Room Key is a $500 million program for the state of California. And to put that in perspective, Los Angeles passed a sales tax for homeless housing a few years ago in 2017, and the $1 billion in Los Angeles will ultimately create 7,000 units. So think how 500 million is going to create. It's obviously good. The Bay Area, 8 Bay Area counties are going to share 100 million. And, you know, it's great that we're spending 500 million, but we need to spend $5 trillion. As a nation, we need to spend in the trillions, because we have such a gap in need. So if you just figure that LA spent $1 billion, they have 66,000 homeless people. And, you know, and that's just according to the numbers. It's probably a lot more, but because if you don't count overcrowded units, just people who are literally have no roof. Mm-hmm. 66,000. And so if 7,000 is $1 billion, LA alone needs $10 billion. And we're talking about the room key, which is 500 million statewide.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's just not enough ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously good, but you know, what I sometimes get concerned about is groups that want to, you know, feel like there's progress really promoting things that are just very small solutions. And the problem with that is people will say, I get this all the time, San Francisco is spending X dollars on the homeless. How can we still have a homeless problem? Well, because we did spend that, but it costs to house the unhoused population and people who have no income or very limited income. It costs a lot more.
And these numbers are just housing numbers. Are they even numbers that go into the services that are needed?
Great point, because Project Room Key is just covering the housing costs. It also requires that you know, the rooms be occupied within 90 days, which means anything that needs work won't really do. And a lot of the places that people want to sell have a lot of work needed. So again, you know, it's, you know, if not for the pandemic, California state budget would have added more for affordable housing. But what doesn't make sense is how the governor, when you change zoning to increase density, so in the Bay Area, streets like University Avenue or San Pablo, heavily transit streets, yet they have a 35-foot height limit, which makes absolutely no sense. That's free to get that additional units, and yet we can't get the city governments or the state government to address that. So That's really sad what happened in Sacramento this session.
Is it a case of just people not wanting affordable units in their area because of the stigma that's around quote unquote affordable housing, with having a certain, how they might see it, undesirable population living there? Is that what it could be, in your opinion?
Well, you know, many of the neighborhoods that don't want affordable housing just don't want any housing. I think I always talk about, When I do these book events for On Generation Priced Out, I always talk about how people in Berkeley, many of them who live in Elmwood and areas where oppose any changes to density, they don't see the traffic on Highway 80 because it's pretty far from them. And Sacramento, before the COVID, had 140,000 people driving from Sacramento to the Bay Area for their jobs.
That's insane.
Just think about that.
For those that don't know, that's like an hour and a half, 2 hour drive, depending on traffic.
Yeah. And, you know, because there's not, you can take the Amtrak to Berkeley, but, you know, the time would take forever on a train. But so people drive. And so when we say we don't want apartments we don't want a 60 foot or an 8-story building on University Avenue or San Pablo, these heavy thoroughfares, we're saying we'd rather have the people create greenhouse gas emissions by moving to Sacramento, where housing is cheaper. I mean, Sacramento's had a big increase in it. When we had the Bay Area economic boom in recent years, Sacramento's population has gone through the roof, and their housing prices and everything, because people are moving to Sacramento and commuting to Oakland, commuting to San Francisco, commuting to Berkeley. You get a job at UC Berkeley, you can't live in Berkeley. And so it's a climate change issue as well as an affordability issue. And yet people just are in denial about it.
How can a state as presumably green and blue as California have all these climate change and issues?
Well,
I think people are surprised.
If we're really honest, Jason, we'd say that our state officials are great at passing Green New Deal resolutions, but they don't want to pass anything that gets drivers of cars potentially upset with them, or homeowners upset with them. So, you know, the old expression, actions speak louder than words. And we've had a lot of talk, but very little action in Sacramento on housing or connected to climate change.
That's so insane, because you can't, you know, driving through San Francisco recently, I went to go visit Shahid Buttar recently, who was doing some stuff in San Francisco. He's the gentleman running against Nancy Pelosi for Congress. And I used to live in the Tenderloin where you work. The homelessness problem there is just so apparent. You can't miss it. And there's this tech population that just walks by it almost as if it's not there. And when it's so in your face, why don't people want to confront this problem?
Well, let me just defend San Francisco, which I rarely end up doing. but per capita, San Francisco spends as much, maybe more than any city. If you look at the population of San Francisco versus what they spend, homelessness has always been, we could spend the whole show talking about what San Francisco can do better on homelessness, but if we take a step back, it's always been, affordable housing was put in the 1949 National Affordable Housing Act, which said that it's the obligation of the federal government to provide safe and affordable housing for every American. How have we done on that? To ask cities and states to make up for this huge federal withdrawal and abandonment of a crisis is just, the economics don't work. And so, you know, we can talk all we want, how I can name you every city in California, how they could do a better job housing homeless people. Absolutely. But the big picture is we need federal resources. I mean, we passed the $100 billion HEROES Act to stop the eviction crisis, and we couldn't even get the Republican Senate to have a vote on it. I mean, the House passed it, $100 billion, and we couldn't get, we haven't had $1 allocated because the House, the Senate won't even take it up. So what does that tell you?
Is it because housing is a commodity and the big developers just don't want to invest in affordable housing because it's not as cost effective for them?
Well, developers, you have to make a profit, that they're in the business, and there are tax credit programs. And it may surprise you to know that the number one affordable housing program in the United States is a tax credit program, which developers get tax credits for building. It's not, you know, a nonprofit's building. Mm-hmm. But no, what it comes down to is, this was not the case before the 70s. But if you look at the current Republican Party and where they hold their seats, they see themselves as in areas that are not with cities. So very few Republican Congress members are in cities. They're in Alabama, Mississippi, you know, Louisiana, North Dakota. They're in areas that don't have these urban problems, so they don't really care. It's not their priority.
Because I also live in West Oakland, and the homeless encampment across the street from the warehouse I live in has exploded in population.
Well, it's going to all the homeless numbers have gone up because people have no incomes and they've lost jobs and we're in a depression. But I'm just saying that, as I said, I could go through and tell you all kinds of things San Francisco, Oakland, and Los Angeles could do better. Absolutely. But if they did everything that I asked them to do, everything, without the federal money, we're kidding ourselves. I mean, the reason that we were able to reduce the homeless population for a while for homeless veterans, We run homeless veterans programs at 1001 Housing Clinic. The reason we were able to do it is there was a special federal program under Obama to give subsidized rents to homeless veterans. Okay, well, that worked great. We really reduced the population. If we did that for all the people who need housing, we wouldn't have a homeless problem.
Mm-hmm. Is it? I know right now in the middle of COVID and a big election, I feel like housing, as important as it should be, because of, you know, the moratorium got lifted on the first of this month, as we're speaking in September, on rents. And we're looking at an eviction crisis that could see tens of millions of Americans throughout the country lose their residence. You would think housing would be number one on both parties' tickets.
Well, it's interesting you say that. In 2000, have you heard of Project Censored, which they talk about the 10 most censored stories? It comes out of Sonoma State, puts out a thing, Project Censored. They've been doing it for like 30 years.
And no,
for the years,
tell me about it.
For the years 2000 and 2001, a story I wrote for a publication about the lack of the presidential race not involved housing, won the ninth most censored story of those 2 years. And I've often said, this is around the 2000 presidential race, and I've often said that I could have won that award every 4 years because housing has never elevated. And this year, even a year ago, before the first Democratic primary, the National Low Income Housing Coalition put our homes, our votes, put together this giant coalition where we were constantly barraging candidates and the media who do the asking at these debates to ask about housing. And despite all of this, you could not get one of these CNN folks to ever ask a question about housing. They're asking questions about obscure foreign countries. It's mind-boggling how the people who are in the national media, they don't suffer from a housing crisis, right?
Right.
They don't even often know people who suffer from a housing crisis. And so we had Elizabeth Warren early on talking about housing a lot, and Bernie Sanders came on board, and we got all the candidates. And even with that, the moderators wouldn't ask a question, and that kind of determined what gets discussed in the debates. And now where we are with the presidential race is that it's really all litmus tests on the kind of country we want and whether we want to continue to have a democracy with Donald Trump. So housing, mm-hmm. or even climate change, housing, these issues become subordinated. It's amazing to me, like I said, in May, Pelosi got $100 billion to make sure there were not these eviction crises, and tenants wouldn't owe the money because we were reimbursing landlords. So there would be none of the problems we're going to have where people don't have the money to pay back rent. And we couldn't even get a vote in that Senate. So you're right. I mean, mass homelessness, the Trump executive order will stop many people from being immediately evicted. But come January, they owe that back rent.
Which is insane. Forgive the rent.
The Cancel the Rent campaign did a phenomenal job, but we just have such resistance in Washington. And so that's why I think, you know, the theory would be that if Biden wins, we will pass the HEROES Act and we'll get that money and rent will be canceled. And I think that will happen. California, you know, came up with a very weak compromise for a blue state with everyone's Democrats run everything. And yet, you know, they require 25% rent payments combined with declarations. It's very cumbersome to use. And so politically, it's difficult to get money for housing. That's why we have the worst affordable housing crisis of any first world nation.
And what's so interesting too is as you're talking, it sounds like the housing crisis and the environment is so intertwined. And is that maybe a better way for us to frame it, to get people to get more involved in addressing this issue?
Well, a lot of people you might notice are addressing it because it fits in with COVID, is the housing crisis is a healthcare crisis. And the fact that the number one cause of getting COVID has become people in overcrowded units. And so they can't create social distancing because they're living, you know, eight to a one bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that I wrote a big study with Megan Sandell of who's now at Boston Medical Center, housing for homeless, about in 1999, about how America's housing crisis affected particularly children's health, asthma and the like. So I'm glad 20 years later, we're still talking about housing as a healthcare crisis, but it's also now a climate change crisis. you'd think that would push us politically. But as I say, we're doing a great job at the grassroots level. There's so many groups around the country involved with federal stuff. But you just have resistant politicians who don't want to spend money on low-income people for anything. And they don't care about climate change, right?
Mm-mm. Not at all. And Donald Trump is kind of against building apartments in single-family zone districts as well, correct?
Yeah, well, Donald Trump's been pretty much a disaster on everything. And some people thought because he was in the real estate business that he would be doing things to at least encourage housing. But he's decided, you know, how it's a racial issue. And, you know, one thing we should mention is when I mentioned that Nixon canceled public housing in the 70s, new public housing, the reason there, even many Democrats were concerned about the idea of moving, of having public housing, because public housing is non-discriminatory. So there was concerns Democrats also faced in places like Maryland that, well, we want to be careful on this public housing because basically white homeowners didn't want to live near blacks. It's very, very blunt about it. That's what it was about. The lack of funding for housing has always had a racial component.
In your latest essay for the LA Progressive, you have a line where you said a war against duplexes in favor of McMansions. That's the position of Donald Trump and Ben Carson. Yet that is where, quote unquote, progressive California stands on ending racist and elitist single family zoning. So there's also an issue with zoning here in the state of California when it comes to single family.
The biggest political hypocrites in the United States are probably in California, in places like Westwood and the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco and Bernal Heights, where these people are all for Black Lives Matter. They're all for social justice. They want to end mass incarceration, but just don't build an apartment in their neighborhood. I wrote a story for Beyond Chrono a while back about two house lawn signs in Portland. One was, the usual one you see that we love everybody, you know, those things you see, mm-hmm. This house believes in science, you know, those signs, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other sign was opposing the zoning reform that would allow apartments in the neighborhood. And it's been widely documented that banning apartments was a strategy for keeping blacks out of neighborhoods because they couldn't afford single family homes, but they could rent. And if there's affordable housing subsidized by the government, there could be no discrimination, which means you are definitely getting non-whites coming into your neighborhood. So you have to keep those apartments out.
Oh, and another issue that we're looking at too is like we have all these wildfires in the hills of California, just leveling homes. And you had another essay you wrote where you feel like that should be kind of the call to build more urban housing.
Well, you'd think so. If what we're going through with the wildfires, the air quality issues, if this isn't prompting us to say we got to get people out of spending 140,000 people driving from Sacramento to the Bay Area for a job, what would it take? I mean, how bad does it have to get before people stop thinking about what's best maybe for their personal life? They want to drive wherever they go or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. We don't even have a sophisticated system of bike lanes in Berkeley or Oakland or San Francisco, really. They're trying in San Francisco, but you compare us to Amsterdam or Copenhagen, or what Paris is doing, or almost any European city. There isn't any major European city I can think of that's as car dependent as we are in our American cities. And you'd think the COVID would really change that.
Mm-mm.
And the wildfires. I mean, you know, logic would say we need to allow 8-story buildings on major thoroughfares so that people don't have to live in paradise and get, you know, burned out constantly.
Mm-hmm. Because this is becoming an annual thing here of cities just being destroyed by wildfires.
It really is. But, I have not seen there was a vote last week in the legislature to allow allow duplexes, which never seemed to be threatening, which really aren't going to bring very many truly affordable, low-income people aren't going to be in a duplex. And even that couldn't pass because people just want McMansions. It doesn't make sense, but this is our progressive California legislature.
Is this kind of a window into the world that we've created under neoliberalism where it's just so kind of all about you that we just can't live any communally anymore? We'd have to have the 3,000 square foot house with the 3-car garage, no duplexes or affordable housing near me. I need a car. I need an SUV.
Well, I would say it's not just an indictment of neoliberalism. It's an indictment of how we describe progressivism, progressive politics. That's what I would say, because many people who identify as progressives oppose apartments on the grounds that it interferes with neighborhood character, which of course means, you know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's an indictment of progressive politics and that's what my book Generation Priced Out is about. It's about how progressive cities are all having these restrictive, racist and elitist housing policies, all while they calling themselves progressive. I mean, Seattle, Portland and Minneapolis have gotten rid of single family zoning, but cities like Seattle, which are, you know, increasingly progressive on so many fronts, yet they can't get major portions of their city to allow apartments because the politicians who call themselves progressive feel very loyal to those constituents. And if you look at how progressive politicians often get elected in their districts, beyond to state or federal office, homeowners are voters and these homeowners don't want apartments. And so the homeowner constituency kind of drives a lot of the political assessments.
I feel like we're looking at kind of, this reminds me a lot of Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law.
Yeah.
Where he talks about how kind of there was this fear that if black people moved in your area, your home value would drop. And I feel people look at their homes because they are the commodity, that if anything comes in your area that's going to disrupt your home value, if you get more, you know, people of color in your area or low income people, then your school district's going to get worse. Your streets are going to get crowded. Well, like it always seems. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Where I pretty much talk about how the boomer generation, which I'm a part of, actually is priced out the millennial generation because of their restrictive housing policies. I tell a story I quote in the book about what happened in Minneapolis, and I saw a video, and you see this video, and a woman actually broke down crying about the prospect of this structure being built across the street from her, and people were saying, who's going to take care of all the mattresses that are left? Who's going to handle the increase in 311 calls? They said it was a threat to their children. And the way the video was shot by a guy, Wedge Live, at Wedge Live, I recommend him in the book. He takes the best videos of these hearings. He didn't reveal what was being built. And if you had just watched that, you would have said, gee, they're probably trying to put either a homeless shelter or a halfway house in this homeowner neighborhood, right? People were crying. They were hysterical. And it was a 10-unit market-rate apartment building in a district that was 80% renter.
Wow.
So this is the hysteria that people get about any apartment building. And these people probably think of themselves as progressive.
It's interesting that they complain about mattresses. Wood Street, where I stay in West Oakland, because the encampment has gotten so large, people from up the hill in the nicer suburban area dump their trash on the street. And as you know, it's not just trash like the trash from your kitchen. It's if you were cleaning out a garage or an attic, like that level of trash. So it's mattresses galore, old furniture galore, refrigerators. I mean, and these, at this point, these things are now in the middle of the street. I've had to move six boats from the street to drive down it.
You know, I think that's why at the local level, the plight of the unhoused is such a big issue, and why there's so much pressure on local governments to do things that often they don't have the resources to do. You know, it's very interesting where we are right now, where because of COVID, FEMA is putting up 75% of the cost of housing the unhoused. So we had 420 tents in the Tenderloin in May, and we have 20 now because we filed a lawsuit. I was involved with a lawsuit where there was a settlement with the city where they had to reduce the tents and people got hotel rooms. And you just think, well, gee, if FEMA permanently provided that rent assistance, we'd have a lot fewer homeless people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it's a great strategy by the National Republican Party to put all the pressure on the cities to solve their own problems and get mad at their local Democratic mayors for not doing a better job.
And that's what I'm seeing happening with Gavin Newsom. Like, people are really, really upset with what's going on in the state of California, because it's not just the Bay Area. LA has a bit of an issue with.
I would say that people should be upset with Gavin Newsom, though, because as governor, he has a platform to make the exact points that we've been discussing in this interview. He could be saying everything that I've just said or you've said, and he could be attacking the federal government and saying, or just saying, wait a minute, we need more help. Where are you? But for a guy who ran for governor under his top priority was housing, we're in the industry, but do you think the average person's even heard what he said about housing on any subject?
No. Not at all. And how do you see something like Operation Room Key working out? Because, you know, the way everyone kind of looked at COVID and the restrictions was temporary, right? This was going to pass over a few months. And now we're finally starting to accept the realization that this is going to be here for a while. Well, so as you said earlier,
When FEMA started funding people to be in hotels, it was an assumption it would be over by July 15th. It was 3 months. And then it was continued to December 15th. And I'm really wondering what's going to happen then, because I wrote an article that laid out a strategy. It's in Beyond Cron about, you know, how San Francisco can end its homeless crisis. And it talked about how you could move the people with money available, just local money, move people from the hotels that FEMA's funded into permanent housing. And I hope the city does that. But for a place, for Oakland and Los Angeles, that don't have anywhere near the local resources to solve the problem, it's going to get worse. Because the economy, people don't have jobs.
Mm-mm. Well, weren't there some new numbers that came out and said there was a bunch of like a million and some new jobs created?
Well, that's compared to where it was last month. But I mean, we're still down. We have a huge unemployment rate. And, you know, the restaurant, a lot of the people like in the Tenderloin are in the restaurant or hospitality industry, which have just been destroyed.
Yes. And there's a slow easing of restrictions here in California, where they're opening up outdoor dining a little bit, but still it's not to the level that it was before. And it's just a scary time, you know, because every time we see restrictions.
It's also a time where it's a great time for affordable housing developers to acquire land, because there can be many private developments that developer can't get financing anymore, but there's separate pots of money for affordable housing. They should be buying these entitled projects and turn them into affordable housing, which just happened in the Monster and the Mission, so at 16th and Mission, but that was a separate kind of deal. But I think you see a lot, there's a lot of private developers who are open to selling their entitled projects. So this could be a boon for affordable housing long term if it's if that opportunity is seized.
Now, there was an article in the LA Times, I want to say earlier in the year, maybe even before the lockdown, about an affordable housing unit that was supposed to get built at, where this motel, this is in Southern California, where a motel was at one point in time, where I guess people had lived in, and people were kind of living in the parking lot of the motel at this point, or what was the motel parking lot, because I believe the motel had gotten leveled, and it had taken years to try to even break ground. And by the time the developer was kind of getting ready to break ground, it would have cost $1 million per unit for like a 10 unit building, and the developer had to pull out because it was too expensive.
Well, you're raising a lot of important issues, which goes to the cost of affordable units. And you probably saw that LA Times analysis about how much it cost. And you know, Tenderloin Neighbor Development Corporation did a beautiful project in the Tenderloin recently, and it was $700,000 a unit. And that's why really the future in this article I wrote about us in the beyondcron.org, how San Francisco could end its homeless crisis, really says you have to build modular housing as they're doing in other countries. Modular is just so much cheaper, but you have to bring the cost down, because if you don't bring the cost down of construction, and these can be 100% union, but they're modular. So some of the exterior is not, the exterior of the building is from, you know, machine made. But we just don't have the resources, and especially with LA putting all this energy and money, the $1 billion, and their homeless population as of March before the COVID went up 14%. With everything they were doing, their homeless population went up 14% before COVID.
Jesus.
So people in the Bay Area, may, you know, Oakland, you see people sleeping under highways, you see stuff in San Francisco, and you think we have the worst problem. Check out Los Angeles, the Skid Row area, and other parts, and we don't have anything like they have. And the numbers are staggering. So, it I don't see any way outside of a massive federal increase, but it takes a while. It's not going to happen overnight. The advantage of what I talk about for San Francisco, or leasing hotels, is that can happen quickly because we have an existing building. But ultimately, it requires new construction to house everyone who needs a place to live.
Do you see possibly, because where I work in East Oakland is near the airport, and it's in an area that isn't developing, and these hotels are kind of a victim of the sports franchises leaving. So the Raiders recently left to Las Vegas, and the Golden State Warriors recently left to San Francisco, and the Oakland A's, the baseball team, are looking, or I think they're getting ready to build a new stadium as well in a different part of Oakland. So this area has pretty much been abandoned. There's really not much there. And I think the county bought one of the hotels in a cluster of hotels. Do you see counties or cities just maybe buying some of these hotels, since ultimately the owners of them were just taking massive losses because of the lack of foot traffic?
Well, that's what Project Room Key is about. And I think Oakland is trying to buy a couple of those hotels by the airport where you're talking about. I think that there's obviously where if the state's funding it, cities want to take advantage because it's not their money. But I can tell you, when you're talking about buying a tourist hotel, like that they're talking about in Oakland, that's different than a residential property, which we have in Oakland and San Francisco and LA, which often the amount of cost after you buy it can be staggering on top of it, not to mention the service costs that you were referring to earlier. So I think there's a lot of illusions about how we think it's better to be a homeowner than a renter in society because you get equity. But nonprofit acquisition of an old SRO means that public money is going to be spending, putting in a new elevator, putting in private bathrooms. You know, these are, and then you can't sell it for a profit. So unless you get a place you can move into, like those Oakland modern tourist hotels, it may not make sense.
Because my fear of the whole thing was because of the area that it's in, and they are kind of gated off, if you will, and again, the lack of any kind of development around there made me look at it from the standpoint of, if you did say, okay, we're going to buy Hotel X. Well, hell, I can say it. We're going to buy the Radisson. You got about 300 plus rooms, but like you said, there's a lot of upkeep. And one thing, I don't know if they really understood, because, you know, no one's ever taken on a project this large, as far as the nonprofits that I work for that are involved, taking on a project this large and taking on a project like this during a pandemic when the economy is kind of in a weird state as well. Coupled with a federal government that doesn't want to get off federal funds to help, that even if you were to go ahead and throw, let's say, the 300 people in these units, that the upkeep wouldn't be there, and it would become one of those things where, like we see with project housing in New York and what we saw in Chicago with Cabrini Green, the upkeep just deteriorates and deteriorates till it becomes a point of contention for the people that live in it and around it, and then people just want to see it gone, and they don't really understand the factors that kind of led to that destruction of that property.
I wouldn't think that would happen in Oakland, because I just think there's different models, and I think the public housing model, there was a separate housing authority that in all these cities, it wasn't accountable to people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of deep problems with the way we did public housing in the United States. So I wouldn't think that would happen in Oakland, but you raise a point I want to mention, because I bring it up in Generation Priced Out about what happened in places like Austin and elsewhere, where when they decide they want to build affordable housing, they want to put it on, they want to put it in areas that may not be that desirable for families.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to have affordable housing in the high up, what they call high opportunity neighborhoods. No, they want to put you, you know, way out away, so you're not near anybody, on a nearer freeway, or, you know, the kind of places. And so they can say, oh, we added X number of affordable units, but in practice, you know, families deserve to live in the same inclusive high opportunity neighborhoods as wealthy families, right? I mean, it shouldn't be this idea of segregation by race and income, so that, oh yeah, we're gonna get to our numbers. We're gonna put these people way out so no one can see them off a major thoroughfare. You know, that's just, and Austin had that debate because the mayor thought he had a great compromise where he said, we'll just put the affordable housing way over there, and the homeowner neighbors don't have to worry. And here's the interesting thing: even that thing in Austin, as I describe in the book, that was opposed by those neighborhoods, even though there wasn't any housing being built near them. They didn't want it. They didn't want to be part of it.
Jeez. And that's kind of how I feel in this part of Oakland, because you have freeways that I feel separate us economically. You have the 580 freeway, which kind of goes through the suburbs and the hills, and you have the 880 freeway, which goes through these kind of more industrial centers in the more city part of Oakland. And being that these hotels are off of the 880 corridor of the freeway that goes through this really industrial part of town, where you see more kind of old factories and such, it's like, we'll put the people that we don't want to deal with over here, and we have these streets that are going to be demarcating lines of value for us. If you live a little bit higher up where you have a view, you know, we're going to change that zip code. And if you live down here, then you're part of the hotel shelter and affordable housing over-policed area of Oakland.
Well, Which your comments in Oakland raise an important point that we need to mention in this interview, which is that Oakland, those concerned about Oakland, as you are and I am, need to look carefully at the so-called progressive politicians of San Francisco who basically don't let housing be built in their neighborhoods. So therefore, you have all these folks gentrifying Oakland because they work in San Francisco, but they can't get housing in San Francisco, so they move to Oakland. And San Francisco not only doesn't care about the commute from Sacramento, but we don't care, the politicians don't care how it affects Oakland. And it's really had an effect. And as you know, because it used to be, I start the book, Generation Priced Out, about the, talking about the Oakland, the warehouse fire, the ghost ship. And how I say, you know, what led me to write the book actually was that, you know, prior to that fire, we all thought, well, artists can afford to live in Oakland. They can't San Francisco. They've been priced out for a long time. But of course, artists and bohemians can live in Oakland. Then you find out they can't afford to live there either in safe and healthy. So all those people die because they couldn't even afford to live in Oakland. And that was before the big boom. It was in 2017. So 16. So the kind of lack of perspective and the narrowness of San Francisco of not thinking about outside their own borders really impacts Oakland. People should complain more in Oakland about what San Francisco politicians are doing.
Well, you also write about how like the rising costs of real estate in San Francisco with this new, you know, it's been here for some time now, but this the tech class that's come in that definitely has dramatically, exponentially increased rent prices in San Francisco, that people started moving to Oakland. Now, Oakland is just dramatically, ridiculously increased in their rent prices. And it's creating, like, again, neighborhoods like I live in where you have homeless encampments that are massive. And the city's solution is not modular homes to the degree that you're talking about. They're moving people into tough sheds that you get at Home Depot.
I mean, again, we could have spent the whole interview with me criticizing how Oakland deals with homelessness, but I do want us just to be fair, because I'm very critical of Oakland. And I always say it's amazing how little publicity it gets compared to San Francisco, but Oakland also doesn't have the resources San Francisco has. And They're part of Alameda County. So the city council doesn't even control the homeless budget, a lot of it, right? Whereas San Francisco is a city and county. So, you know, the idea of using tough sheds at all would never fly in San Francisco. But there's a desperation in Oakland. It needs a lot more resources. And that's why I think Oakland's going to get a lion's share of the Bay Area's Project Room Key, because the governor knows that you know Oakland has just a really out of control problem, and they don't have the resources. They passed a ballot measure in March, this Measure O, that will increase homeless resources, which is great because all these cities need to have developed separate local funding sources because it's not the state and federal government haven't come through.
Have you seen any of the room key shelters in any other cities like Livermore, which is like a much nicer city than Oakland?
No.
Because they definitely look different.
But one thing about places like, let me just mention that one of the reasons that Oakland and San Francisco have always had more homeless people, you know, there's these other cities in the Bay Area kick people out, don't provide any services. So if you go become homeless in Contra Costa and they don't have any place for you and they don't even care, you go to Oakland. It's right next door, right?
San Francisco seems to have more services though, right?
No, right. And you know, that's why there's always an issue about the services provoke people from coming. But the reality is that people are there and you have to house people. You have to do something. But if you had federal money, then they would have served. They would have housing, more affordable housing in Contra Costa. They would have built more in other parts of the Bay Area that they don't want to spend local money.
So you're saying that and you know, we can't wrap the housing crisis up in just one thing, but a big problem is historically, federally, we just don't, first of all, fund affordable housing.
Exactly. I mean, the statistics are clear. 75% of eligible recipients don't get any aid.
That's a huge number.
It really is. And it keeps growing.
Jeez. And when housing is a commodity, how do you then look at it as a way to help housing people that are kind of left out of your economic system, right?
Well, again, it used to be that public housing was the place that those people would live. And that's how other countries do it. And we decided, just like with healthcare, just like with transit, that we don't provide public services. And if there's one thing we've learned above all from the COVID response in the United States is that, you know, in the big picture, the United States is sort of a failed government. We don't provide any public services that our people need to the level that they need. I mean, public transit's dying all around California and the nation because if the same Republican Senate that doesn't want to fund the HEROES Act for housing doesn't want to fund any money for transit assistance. So, you know, Oakland's being decimated with the lack of bus service, BART's being decimated. And there's just, this is our country and we have to change it.
And those changes are beyond the ballot box, right?
Well, as I said, I think we've shown from Clinton and Obama, I mean, electing Democrats helps, obviously, but because they were open to it. But now that we have the grassroots base that we had not had in prior Democratic presidents, I think we can capture the federal money that's needed. So believe it or not, there is room for optimism that we can finally meaningfully deal with the housing crisis. But the notion that we can deal with it locally alone, the only way you can do that is if, like San Francisco, and you pass ballot measures that tax businesses to fund it significantly, that Prop C did in November 18, and that money will be coming around. But most cities in California, including Los Angeles, simply do not have the funding stream to anywhere close to deal with the housing crisis in this country.
And that goes back to Bernie Sanders' main campaign point, right? In 2016 and then in 2020, that we need to tax the billionaire class that pays little to no federal income taxes, right?
Well, I'll leave you with this thought. San Francisco does have a billionaire's tax on the ballot for this November. And why didn't California do a billionaire's tax? The legislature, our progressive legislature, why didn't they just do a billionaire's tax? Why did they couldn't get 2/3 vote? Why don't we have a state billionaire's tax? Why don't we have, you know, a federal? It makes no sense that, and many billionaires say they should be taxed more. So it's not like we don't have the resources. We're not like El Salvador, where they're in desperate, or Mexico, which doesn't have the we have the wealth. We decide to let wealthy people keep it and have streets filled with tents. So I'll leave you with that, and I hope people pick up Generation Priced Out, because I think they'll understand that I really break down city by city what cities are doing wrong on affordable housing.
Mr. Shaw, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. Is there anything else that you wanted to shout out before we take off?
Just let me know when it runs so I can help promote it.
Thank you very much,
okay.
Mr. Shaw.
Thank you very much.
And don't hang up. I'm going to play some music. Don't hang up.